I want to say hi to Ken Braun, who's on the line this morning. Let's go ahead and talk with him. Ken is the policy analyst for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Lansing. Let's welcome him to the broadcast today. Ken, good morning. How are you?
Morning. Not bad. How about yourself?
Oh, doing pretty good. How much snow you got downstate?
Not too bad. About 3 or 4 inches on the ground right now, and you know, it's kind of finally warming up a little bit around here. It was really cold yesterday.
Quite a bit of snow coming to the Lower Peninsula, and the UP is expecting beyond 13. So tell your friends it's time to come up and ski and snowmobile.
That sounds good. I'm a skier. I'd love to.
I'll tell you. Well, that's cool. We're going to be ready for you now. So this weekend, actually, we've been ready for a while for skiing. We've been keeping the snow cannons going pretty good, but I don't think most people downstate probably realize that, I imagine.
A couple weeks ago there was reports of no snow up there, but
there was plenty of no snow, but but when you've got a snow cannon, you can make it pretty good. So, that wasn't why I had you on today. So we're going to have a good conversation nonetheless about, well, this maybe actually probably was part of the reason I had you on, because tourism helps pay the bills at least somewhat, because we've got a state budget shortfall, and we've been hearing more and more about it, and I have I hate to say it laughingly, but I did start cracking up when our election coverage was going on the night of the election. Already, as soon as the polls were closing, it was like the people who were to spread the evil rumors about budget shortfalls waited until the polls closed. And then within moments from then, people start saying in beta whispers, there's going to be a big budget shortfall. And I'm like, gee whiz, the governor ran on this balanced budget thing, and now we've got a shortfall and didn't make it. And now I talked last week with the director of management and budget for the state on the program, who said that we're facing, and I know the numbers are varying widely all over the place, but she said they think we're facing a $3 billion shortfall. That's the highest number I'd heard so far. I'm sure you've heard several numbers yourself, Ken.
Yeah, the $3 billion, let's say, a little bit exaggerated. They're assuming that they're counting the $2 billion roughly that the single business tax normally takes in and continues to take in until the end of the year. It's next year when the legislature abolished the single business tax, and that will disappear, and they're assuming that there is no replacement for it, which would suit me just fine, but that hasn't been the general perception of the governor and most of the legislature and what they've been saying. So if you assume that that all is put back, it's more of an $800 to $1 billion shortfall. But either
way, it's just chump change in comparison.
It's $40 billion budget, so yeah.
Unbelievable. Hold that thought just a second, Ken. We've got to check a quick check of that forecast. We do it every 10 minutes. 8:20 right now is what time it is. Weather on the O's for you this morning. Let's check that right now. Go ahead and take a look and see what we're going to be ending up with. Talking right now to Ken Braun, who's a policy analyst for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, about the state budget right now. So we're all crossing our fingers. But $800 million to $1 billion budget shortfall, Ken, that's still not a lot of chump change to be sneezing at right now. So I would hope we've got some good cutting to do, but it always seems like when they cut, it's always the areas that gets people reacting to where we won't be throwing a fit if taxes get raised. We end up cutting funds for old people. We end up cutting funds for children. We end up cutting funds for the police. I mean, why does it always seem like those are the areas we go for?
Those are generally the areas that are announced when the people that don't wish to make the cuts and would prefer to get the revenue instead will suggest the most scariest sounding things they can. But even when you throw out those things, there are ways to trim expenses, spend wiser, spend more effectively without spending as much money within those things. For example, when they say, oh, we're going to cut, we'll have to cut schools, and there was reported in the Detroit News yesterday a $222 per pupil cut might be in the offing. Just as one example, the school district my kids go to school in, East Lansing, saved around $200 a pupil just by privatizing their custodial services a couple of years ago. A very simple way to completely mitigate that entire drop in per pupil shortfalls, they basically gave themselves a $200 per pupil increase.
And how does that work? I've heard that said that if you privatize that you'll be a lot cheaper and so forth. But, when you look at that, I mean, custodians still have to be paid. And because I'm just playing devil's advocate. I want to understand this a little bit. I mean, they still have to be paid. They still have to, provide for your employees and so forth. I mean, what do they cut the salaries down, the minimum wage or something for those custodials when they go private? Or?
Well, if I told you, Greg, that we were going to put custodials on the air instead of you, Do you think a custodial service would do a better job of running a radio station?
Absolutely.
Well, in most cases, when people switch industries where they're not, you know, and they're attempting to do a mission that's not in their core function, they do it less efficiently and more expensively. The custodian and school districts are in the business of teaching kids, and they've hired professional teachers who do a, and professional administrators who their focus in you know, they don't go to college and go through those training programs in order to learn how to hire, you know, and to administer a custodial staff and a food service staff and a bus, you know, transportation service. And when they go to professionals who are in those businesses, they find people, you know, the costs will go down, the efficiencies go up because they are hiring people who that's their business and they know how to do it better.
Well, that actually makes sense. I understand what you're coming from. When you need to fix the sink, you call a plumber and not a car mechanic.
Exactly. Or, yeah, or a radio station on-air personality. I mean, how are you fixing sinks? Right?
So it's just the efficiency of knowledge of doing business on those things.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, I definitely wanted to clear that up because nobody's ever made the statements that you just made right there, and I wanted to make sure we all had the same playing field on that. Forgive me for interrupting, but I wanted to get to that. There's several other things that I know I wanted to have you talk about, too, on that in regard to that budget. So that just takes care of one school. I imagine not every school can have those kind of savings. What's some other areas maybe they need to be thinking about?
Well, actually, so far, the numbers I see when they've done just for the keeping on the custodial privatization, generally those savings are in the range of about $100 a pupil or better in almost every district that I've – I mean, this isn't my particular area of expertise – Michael Fave in our office looks into this more intensely, but almost every time one of these districts does one of these privatizations, it comes up with real significant dollars, and that's just one service. There's food service, which is another one that isn't done often. I mean, for the most part, we're looking at a small fraction of the school districts around the state, you know, in the range of 30% or less, that privatize one of these services, and very few privatize all of the big three. So there's big, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in savings still out there to do that for these sorts of things. And in other areas where often cited, we're going to have to cut this if we don't get this money, for example, the state police. We've estimated upwards of $65 million could be saved by not necessarily privatizing, but instead of putting the comparably more expensive state troopers on the highways, we could contract it out to local county sheriffs. This is done a lot in Oakland County, and save as much as $65 million and have no loss in services. We will have we'll still have police officers patrolling the roads. We'll just have sheriff's departments instead of state troopers doing it.
Now, I've had some state troopers on the program who and actually had a debate on the subject. It was really interesting with the state police issues, and had said that they're concerned that we wouldn't get the police protection that we would get with state police because the state police are trained in so many areas and the training and overall abilities of state troopers can far surpass those of, at least in some areas, of deputies and so forth like that.
I've heard that argument, and generally I've heard it boil down to the fact that a lot of those state troopers are trained as higher-level criminal investigators and the likes of those things, where you don't really need that for somebody who's patrolling the roadways. It makes more sense, you know, we don't need the highest trained officer in every single place. You need a police officer on the corner watching what's going on. And so it's more or less an inefficient use of resources when if you've got a police officer who's trained, I'm just being completely exaggerated here, as a Green Beret and an attorney, being the person who's out there patrolling every state highway. That's, you don't need that out there. You need somebody who's able to drive the car effectively, to keep an eye out on traffic, to know what to look for people that are speeding and driving recklessly and driving drunk. That's the sort of patrol you need. I mean, I seriously doubt most people see a great deal of distinction when it comes to road patrols between the Oakland County Sheriff's Department and the state police. As long as you see the officer out there protecting you, that's what's important.
Ken Braun, I've got to take a news break right now. Can you hang on just a little bit?
Yes, sir.
All right, do appreciate it. Ken Braun, is the policy analyst in Lansing for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy on 1270 WMKT and 1340 WMBN. Weather on the talk station. Conversation with Ken right now, as a matter of fact. Ken, good morning. Welcome back, sir. Appreciate you being with us here today.
Thank you.
Good talking to you this morning. Appreciate it. We're talking about state budget issues and what we're going to be walking into. Ken, and just to catch everybody up, in case we're flipping on the radio and waking up this morning, having that first cup of coffee, what is the current numbers you think we're looking at right now as far as how deep the state's going to have a shortfall and have to do some cutting this year?
I believe the number for this year is in the neighborhood of about $800 million, of which three of that is roughly speaking, the school aid fund. The other five is the rest of the budget, rest of the state portion of the budget, excluding federal money.
And we talked about a little bit, too, I think one of the big things that I think people are going to have to start facing in this state, it sure sounds like, and I'd like to get your thought, is that does Michigan do stuff, I mean, budgetary-wise, we get a lot of, there's no doubt we get a lot of services in this state.
Mm-hmm.
Do people just, have people just come to expect that, or is it time to start saying, you know, it's time to pay the piper, and maybe we shouldn't be having the state involved in certain aspects of our lives that it is, you know, wow, good program, but I don't know if we can afford it. Maybe that's the type of thing we need to start thinking about.
Well, the latter is certainly the thing we need to start thinking about, and you're right. The former is people have, at least from the perspective of some of the political class, believes that people have become conditioned to needing these or wanting these services and will raise a significant outcry if they're gone. As we were discussing earlier, there's a lot of ways where we can continue providing the services and save hundreds of millions of dollars just by doing it smarter. But there's no question there are services that, I mean, I can rattle off a few that the state didn't even do 10 years ago, things that were just created back in the end of the last decade in the late 90s when the state was flush with money, when we had more tax revenue than we knew what to do with, but we always know what to do with it, and we find places to spend it. There's a merit award for college students that was created, completely didn't exist. Now it's giving thousands of dollars in scholarships to Michigan college-bound students where they just never got that before, and state government had the money available, created this program, and now there's no, you know, you can't kill it because you're perceived as cutting money for college students, and there's big fights about it, and they just managed to reform the program, quote unquote, and increased the amount of the award.
Let me ask you about that and stop you just real quick, because I know the other side is going to come back and say, now, look, that one's a good one, because that ends up making more money for the state. For every dollar in tax revenue, we make X amount of dollars back, because we get highly educated workforce who ends up making more money than what they would have had they not done so. Now, that's the other side's theory on it. What's your thought?
Well, I think we're seeing our highly educated workforce getting trained here and seeking a pleasant peninsula in Florida, more or less, in a lot of cases right now. Certainly, an educated workforce is an important thing, but the question becomes, I doubt the numbers as far as the dollar going in and the dollar coming back, and also, excuse me, the numbers don't seem to bear out that assertion. And again, this is a benefit that, you know, we're not saying these kids wouldn't be going to school. We're saying we've created this scholarship that didn't exist back when the state was doing much better. So if you want to look at it, when we created the scholarship is, you know, since then is when our economy has had its roughest time. I'm not saying the two are related, but certainly it didn't result in us. I mean, is the argument that our economy could be any worse than it is right now if we didn't have this scholarship? The point is the scholarship itself is not part of that equation, even to the extent that that equation exists, and it's one of those programs where we were clearly doing without it for, you know, the 150 years of the state's existence nearly to that point. We didn't have this scholarship, and we're doing just fine. And at this point, can we afford things like that when we simply didn't need it before?
You know, Ken, I'm just questioning that I've always wondered why states didn't ever consider maybe doing, if they wanted to help college students, maybe doing low-cost loans and maybe extreme slow payments over a period of time. At least over the years, the state would get their money back at some point.
There have been problems with the student loan program at the federal level.
That is true.
I'm not going to claim to be an authority on that. I do know the federal government is kicking around that idea. There was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal questioning the program just yesterday.
That sounds good in theory, but if you don't have people to execute it, I guess you run into a lot of problems too.
Yeah, and in some cases we're talking about kids that are going to school anyway. All we're doing is reducing the cost of it for a student who's already going to be there. So, you know, if I'm paying this money to go out to school, I'm going to presumably make a whole lot more over the course of my lifetime. What is the value in helping me, you know, mitigating my costs when it's the money is benefiting directly to me?
Sure.
Shouldn't I pay for that?
I guess a big problem is, how do you figure out who's the actual poor person that deserves it over top of the quote-unquote rich or well-to-do and so forth? That's not easy to prove sometimes.
One of the hardest things in the world sometimes.
You got it, yeah. Hold that thought just a second. We've got to do the Wall Street Journal report and weather on the O's real quick. Ken Braun is with us, policy analyst in Lansing from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. We're looking at basically what, I guess, Ken, what nobody keeps mentioning is that this is that single business tax that everybody was wanting to get rid of, that they're complaining is a shortfall. And already I've been hearing discussions of a tax increase all over the place. Like, my gosh, I'm starting to wonder if maybe it's time that we do a ballot petition to stop people from being able to overtax us. It works in other states. There's a lot of states that have those that you can't, the individuals can't put taxes on top of your of you without voter approval.
I think there's a lot of merit in making it harder for the basically anything that takes the hands out of the very politicized atmosphere of Lansing and puts it in the Constitution, you know, creates a barrier on those sorts of things, I think has a lot of merit as a way of checking the growth and power of government. And as far as the single business tax goes, there are three states that more or less don't tax businesses at all directly. South Dakota, Wyoming, and Nevada. Every single one of those states grows faster than the national average. If you go back to when Michigan's high water mark for jobs was, which was April of 2000, and calculate forward, those three states have grown faster than the national average for job growth. Michigan, as the statistic would imply, has fewer jobs now than it did back in April of 2000. We're not only not keeping pace with the national average, we've gone backwards. And the coincidence here is that our business tax, by that same rating, the Tax Foundation rating, our business tax is ranked as 50th, dead last. And those three, with no tax, are tied for first. So there's a very good case to make for, if we had no business single business tax during that period, we would have had many, many more jobs, and the tax revenue from other sources of all those people working would have more than made up for the business tax revenue that we don't have.
What would you say to those who say that's not fair? Business should have to pay their fair share, and you've heard that before, I'm sure.
A quote from Ronald Reagan regarding taxes or government's approach to businesses was that if it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. And it's an old adage that you tax things that you want less of. And so, you know, we've got the worst business tax in the nation, and we've got fewer businesses, fewer and fewer every day as a result.
Well, that would explain taxing cigarettes and beer like they are these days, I guess. If you want less of them, at least in theory, I guess that's so.
Exactly.
Although it almost makes me just as a quick sidebar on that, I've often wondered if there's parts of government right now, especially state governments across the country, that want to see people continue to smoke and so forth. I mean, I'm sure the health departments don't, but boy, when you look at the revenue coming in off these, quote, sin taxes, you're definitely starting to see that we're becoming more and more reliant on those things.
That's a valid point. It's an interesting relationship you get in when a government presumes to want to get rid of something, but then starts getting addicted to the revenue coming from it. It's own kind of tobacco addiction. For example, the tobacco settlement, the lawsuit settlement against the tobacco companies that Michigan has been getting money from since the end of the last decade, is a direct cause of that merit award being created in the first place. It was money that came in from, you know, effectively from cigarettes, and it created a brand new spending program.
It's amazing that a state like Michigan that has seen its ups and downs in the auto industry and has betted a lot of their taxes on taxing manufacturers and business over the years to keep things going, has not saw the realization, because there's been other downturns, maybe not as bad as this, maybe worse than this, depending on who you talk to. But correct me if I'm wrong on this, it just seems like logic to put yourself to start putting that stuff in the bank and hang on to it for the rainy day instead of looking for these new spending programs.
And very little of that got done. I mean, we had a decent sized, by you know today's standards, budget stabilization fund, but that got spent pretty quickly when the revenue started not coming in. When we should have been cutting, then we should have been looking at it and saying, oh boy, we're really running out of revenue. And instead of going to raid the piggy bank first thing, we should have started cutting out some of these brand new created programs. But the brand new created programs are now sort of middle-aged created programs. We have no budget stabilization fund. We continue to lose money every year from a tax system that we're attempting to save and maintain instead of, as you say, look at some places to trim revenue and to trim the taxes.
The policy analyst in Lansing for the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Now, can you bring up the kind of ideas we've talked about with state legislators? I'm sure you do. I'm sure you get that opportunity, at least in private, if not publicly, to talk with them. I mean, what's the reaction you keep hearing in Lansing on these kind of things?
Not every lawmaker, but a lot of lawmakers, the ones the collectively protect these programs, will argue on the merits of what it does, the good things it does for people. And there's no question, if you're a college student going off to school and you've got a state program that's giving you a few thousand dollars to offset your tuition, that's a good program for you. And a lawmaker can claim credit for that. They can send a newsletter out to their constituents saying, look at this great program we have. What they can't do is, and what they won't do is send a comparable newsletter to all 10 million people in Michigan telling them how much that program is costing them so that the person getting the benefit can go off to school. And so it's a big advantage to be able to claim credit for giving away money. And it's really hard to kill things when you're there cutting the ribbon on the big gift, and the other people don't really see the connection between the money they're paying out and this program coming back. So these become very very hard things to kill when you have these concentrated constituencies benefiting from them.
Well, let's use that example. College education for the kids, how much is it costing me to make sure that these college funds are available?
That individual program, I can't tell you how much, but when you add up all of these things, how much is it costing you to make sure that your local school district has personally hired custodians who cost more than if they'd contracted it out, or bus drivers or food service, or how much does it individually cost you to maintain state police road patrols instead of county sheriffs, or to maintain a health insurance program for teachers that might cost upwards of $400 million more than it needs to if we had a comparable program that cost much less. All of these things add up over time and result in a higher tax burden that's driving businesses out of Michigan.
Well, that one, I think, is costing us all a lot of money. We can't argue that one a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start seeing money go and take off and so
right.
forth.
Right. I mean, it would take me several hours to catalog all of the things that create that tax burden. It doesn't take a politician who's championing some of these programs long at all to send a note out to the person benefiting from them saying, this is a great program, I brought it to you.
But I did it for you, vote for me.
Right.
So who are the people that are really supporting change, and are they the majority in Lansing?
Change in the direction of cutting spending has rarely been a majority in Lansing. there are some voices. We're not a partisan affiliated organization, so I'm hesitant to name specific names. But there are always some isolated lawmakers, some in the some of the policy voices in Lansing who will say, hey, we need to trim expenses here. But the problem that often happens when people outside I can make these claims and nobody's going to vote against me, or they can't. There's nothing they can do to me. But a lawmaker who makes these pronouncements is going to get a police officers union, for example. The state will go and attempt to say something to his constituents, perhaps, or a union that represents those custodial workers who are no longer working for the school district will take umbrage at that, and there'll be consequences in rhetoric and otherwise to pay for making these suggestions, and so you see much less of it.
So with that in mind, I mean, we've got an issue right here. I mean, you've got to have people elected. I wouldn't want to go to an appointed system of government by any stretch. So, but that's an inherent flaw in the system, though, is that they do have to pay back their constituents, at least to a certain extent, or we've grown accustomed to it, what have you. How in the world do you get these kind of reforms passed when the current nature of how the political process works points against it on a regular basis?
Real problem, and it's a political problem that requires a political solution. To some extent, there's got to be a change in the incentives. People, the voters who do care about these things, and I personally believe that they would be a majority if the costs were laid out to them, need to be informed and need to kind of take a look at, some of the things like what we have on our website, Mackinac.org, spelled like the island, not the city. We've laid out right there on our front page a number of these spending items and put the price tags right on them, what it would cost to get rid of these things or reform them. These are the things people need to become more aware of and need to be, even I would suggest, a lot more of the political forces that do want change need to be bolder about making the costs better known, more explicit. They need to become part of the public debate. They need to become, in a lot of cases, part of the campaign debates. And we need to start talking about spending and putting that on the agenda instead of talking about revenue, as if it's something that only belongs to government and doesn't belong to the people we're taking it from.
Ken Braun, I appreciate you spending some time this morning. I'm looking at the flag, noticing we're almost out of time right now. If somebody wants to check out what you're all doing, Mackinac.org, the place to go?
Yes, sir. Mackinac.org, spelled like the island, not the city, with a C there. And, and we have a whole bunch of budget stuff right on the front page there. There's $1.8 billion in savings, some of which I've been talking about here, is mapped out right there.
Sounds fair enough. Ken Braun, good talking to you today.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
Take care. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks.
That's Ken Braun, the Mackinac Center for Public.